Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. Now, we're going to begin in the Middle East because the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas is in trouble and there are still 59 Israeli hostages left in Gaza. It's thought that out of those, 25 are still alive. Well, last week, President Trump once again threatened Hamas with hell to pay if they weren't all released. And Israel is now turning the screws on Hamas too. It's already stopped food, fuel and other aid from getting into the territory. Today it announced it was also cutting off electricity supplies. Here's the country's energy minister, Eli Cohen.
I've just signed the order to stop supplying electricity immediately to the Gaza Strip. We will use all the tools at our disposal to bring back the hostages and ensure that Hamas is no longer in Gaza.
Well, I've been speaking to the Israeli journalist Noga Tarnopolsky about the impact, first of all, that this decision to sever the electricity could have.
Well, despite the energy minister's kind of bombastic public declaration, its meaning on the ground is very, very little. Israel is supplying electricity, or was supplying electricity until today, just to one desalinization plant in Gaza. It's not supplying electricity to Gaza. So this declaration seemed more destined to either impress the Netanyahu government's base or to impress Hamas in one way or another, or to try and show that Israel is still relevant in these negotiations, as the Americans appear to have basically taken over.
Yes, I mean, as I mentioned, Donald Trump has once again weighed in, and it emerged, of course, that the US has been holding direct talks with Hamas. Has that not gone down well with the Israeli government?
The Israeli government has been absolutely mute. It's really interesting to observe from here. This is obviously very bad news for Netanyahu, but the Israeli government hasn't said a word, and the Israeli public appears quite confused by what is happening with the American president, who Netanyahu has really sold Israelis as his top ally. So there's a lot of confusion. For the families of hostages, this is a very scary moment, and they have all turned to Trump. In the absence of Israel appearing to have any impact at all, and with the Israeli government just saying no to any possible solution for long-term governance in Gaza that was proposed either by the international community or by Arab nations, these families have turned to Donald Trump for help. And we had a series of quite remarkable statements this evening from Adam Bowler, who is the chief hostage envoy, who described Hamas as nice guys, guys just like us, and who basically said, I'm quoting, we're not an agent of Israel, and that the US is now on its own path in these discussions with Hamas.
Yes, I mean, the release of the remaining hostages, as I understand it, that was meant to be part of those phase two negotiations of the truce. I mean, have those even begun yet?
They have not. And I think they're unlikely to in any formal framework even tomorrow. The Israeli government did accede to the US request and said it would send a delegation to Doha tomorrow, but it seems to be a delegation in name only. The new chief negotiator is Netanyahu's right-hand man, Ron Dermer. He's not going to Doha. It appears to be a low-level technocratic team, and they have not yet been given their marching orders. The cabinet hasn't even discussed yet what this team will or will not be allowed to negotiate. So I don't see those talks bearing fruit. But again, the Americans appear to have lost patience, and they are now running their own board of negotiations with Hamas. And the understanding in Israel is that if and when the Americans announce an agreement with Hamas tonight, for example, Adam Bowler was even discussing the possibility of a truce 10 years long, that Netanyahu will not have a choice but to accept it.
Israeli journalist Noga Tarnopolsky. Well, staying in the Middle East, we're going to head north to Syria now, and what's been the worst outbreak of violence and bloodletting in the country since the fall of the Assad regime at the end of last year. The British-based monitoring group, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, says more than 1,000 people have been killed in the space of just a few days. Most of them, it says, civilians living in areas traditionally loyal to the ousted president along Syria's Mediterranean coast. The fighting began when the country's new Islamist-led security forces were ambushed by fighters loyal to Bashar al-Assad. Further clashes ensued, together with revenge killings against the Alawite community, the minority sect to which the Assad family belonged. While Syria's new interim leader, Ahmed al-Sharaa, has called for remnants of the former regime to surrender and for the rest of the country to unite.
What's currently happening in the country comes within the expected challenges. We have to preserve national unity and domestic peace, and God willing, we can live together in this country.
Well, earlier today I talked to Heba. She's Alawite and spoke to me from Banias, one of the towns worst affected by this week's violence, and I asked her what she had seen.
They came and attacked our neighbourhood. Our neighbours were killed, including children. They came and they took everything, gold, everything. And for the last 3 days, we've had no water and no power. We had to use batteries, whatever we could, to stay connected. They came and they smashed up our car and then they stole it. They stole all of the cars in the neighbourhood. They even went to the supermarket and they took everything from the shelves. They robbed the supermarket.
And who is they? Who were they, the fighters that came to your town?
Shishan.
It was Chechens. Chechens and the army of Ahmed Sharaa, who were asked to go to the coast. They killed our neighbour in front of his child.
You must have been very, very scared.
We were really afraid. We were waiting for our turn. We didn't know when it would come. We saw death. We saw people dying in front of us. And now all of our friends, our neighbours, they're gone.
Do you think these attacks, these massacres, were they revenge killings for all the crimes of the Assad regime? Do you think that's what was happening?
What the Assad regime did was a response to things that were done by the Nusra Front, for example. We've never seen something like this in Syria before. Killing people one by one. Executions.
And what is happening today? Are things quieter today?
Today it is calmer. There has been some gunfire, but they've come and they've taken away the bodies because they heard that journalists and correspondents were coming. They killed innocent people in cold blood who had nothing to do with any of this.
Heba speaking to me from Banias on Syria's western coast. Well, there's been international condemnation of the violence from a number of quarters, including the US. The Secretary of State Marco Rubio called on Syria's interim government to hold accountable what he called radical Islamist terrorists. Lina Sinjab is our correspondent in the capital, Damascus. So has the violence now abated or is it still continuing?
Well, it seems that there are some sporadic clashes still happening in different parts of the coastal areas, mainly around the oilfield refinery in Latakia. And we are still unable to confirm the exact number of the death, but, human rights groups are saying the number of people killed is likely to rise over 1,000 so far. More than 700 of them are civilians.
Yes, huge numbers of deaths. Large-scale attacks. I mean, some people are talking about massacres, aren't they? Who's been responsible for some of those attacks on civilians?
Well, the wide records and testimonies that we've managed to spoke to are accusing factions affiliated to the interim government forces. These factions came into several villages accompanied by foreign fighters. Some residents described that they could be Chechen fighters, but also said some civilians held up arms and joined these forces and conducted, mass killings of, even families who were were safe in their homes. They were chased and killed after robbing their homes. So this is really causing a lot of anger across the country, especially among people who revolted against Assad. They feel that they've revolted against killing, against atrocities, and they don't want people who are in charge today to commit similar crimes.
And on the foreign fighters, as you say, some people describe them as Chechens, and we heard that too. I mean, are they from Chechnya, or where do they come from?
Well, it's really hard to tell. And we knew when the new leadership toppled the Assad regime, it was led by Hayat Tahrir al-Sham with its leader, who is now the interim president, Ahmad al-Sharra. We knew that there were some foreign fighters among their ranking and among the fighters who joined forces with them. But it's hard to pin down who are they and where are they. There has been some reports in the past 3 months that they've seen some foreign fighters. In some areas, the families and the residents were not happy with their presence, and the interim government pulled them out of villages and towns where people didn't want to see any foreigners around them. But what happened over the past 2 days happened also after remnants of Assad regime ambushed members of the security officers of the interim security officers and killed dozens of them. And that's where reinforcement arrived with different factions to restore order. But in fact, what happened is that some of them conducted mass killing. They were joined with these kind of Chechens when the killing happened.
So what can the interim government do to try and keep a lid on it? Or is it not strong enough? Does it not have full control over all these factions and militias in order to stop more killings happening in the future?
Well, they are really rushing to try and restore order. And you can see their actions. The interim president, Ahmad al-Sharra, addressed the nation on Friday evening, but also went to the mosque this morning at dawn prayer and also called for national unity. And just like in the early hours of the afternoon, he announced forming a committee formed from judges, lawyers and army officers to investigate the killing. He stressed that it's important to establish civil peace and to hold people accountable, those who are perpetrators from both sides, whether factions affiliated to the interim government or remnants of the Assad regime who caused this violence. They should be brought to justice, and they are really acting swiftly to work on that. Now, people on the ground want to see transparency in this process. They want to know what's the judicial system that is going to be applied once this whole round of violence is stopped and those who are conducting these killings are stopped.
That was Lina Sinjab, our Syria correspondent, speaking to me from the capital, Damascus. You're listening to NewsHour. And coming up in a few minutes' time, as one of Paris's most popular museums, the Pompidou Centre, prepares to close for 5 years, art lovers get to take a final peek.
It's a place where I would go often, so it would be a little strange.
Yes, there is a sort of last day mood.
It brings a lot of people here, so if it closes, it will be just kind of empty here.
More from Paris shortly. Our main headlines from the newsroom this hour. Israel says it's cutting off all electricity to Gaza to try to put pressure on Hamas to release more hostages. And Elon Musk has said that no matter how much he disagreed with the policies of the Ukrainian government, he would never withdraw its access to his Starlink communication system. This is James Menendez with NewsHour live from the BBC. Now, this week it was announced that female tennis players on the WTA tour will get paid maternity leave for the first time. It'll enable more than 320 players to take up to 12 months off while they have a baby. The money is coming, in part at least, from Saudi Arabia's Public Investment Fund, a partner of the WTA tour. But that's raised concerns in some quarters about sport washing, the use of the country's huge wealth to improve its image abroad while changing little at home. I've been speaking to the former world number one, Victoria Azarenka, who's been pushing for the maternity leave as a member of the Players' Council. She took time off in 2016 to have her son. She first told me about reaction to the announcement.
Everybody is super happy, super excited. I feel like this has been the most positive news I have seen of any other initiative we've ever done.
And what do you think the big picture here is for players? Does it mean that they don't have to choose between their careers and motherhood?
I think so. And I also would say that the stereotype of having family and being a professional athlete for women has been broken. I think it's already been broken a few years ago, as we see a lot more athletes choosing the path of having a family and continue their career. So I feel like now it's just another level of comfort that we give our players to maybe have less worries about doing that step if they choose to do that.
What was it like for you when you gave birth to your son Leo back in 2016, I think? You know, what was that decision like, and what was it leaving the sport temporarily like?
It was shocking for sure. It was scary. We didn't even have the rules that were protecting mothers on tour. I had to take my break as an injury, which was pretty weird, and I couldn't really understand. And it didn't really comfort me at that time. So there were always those, you know, first steps to start the change and bring the conversation. It was also not a matter of if, it was a matter of when. And I truly believe, you know, kind of looking back now, that the purpose of me coming back was even bigger than was just to play tennis, because I wanted to create opportunities for other players, for other women, to hopefully inspire. And I've been so grateful for all the other players before us who moved the needle for women's sports and for opportunities for us.
Can I just get you to address the concerns that some have expressed about the source of the money for this maternity leave fund? Are you comfortable with the source of that money, given the criticism that's long been leveled at Saudi Arabia for the way it treats women?
Well, I've addressed this issue, and I think it's important to speak about what you know personally. I've never been to Saudi. This conversation has started about 2 years ago with them. And for me, throughout this process, was pretty incredible to see actually the support and eagerness to see programs like this happen. And this is the first time we see this happen in sports. And I think that is a huge testament to that. They were very excited from the beginning and how we can make this happen. But also, what's important is they wanted it to come from players as well.
And just finally, I mean, you talked about, you know, wanting to spread this to other sports and other fields. I mean, if other sports did want to do something similar, do you think they'd have to turn to something like Saudi Arabia's public investment fund? Because, you know, actually finding the money is pretty difficult.
Well, I think that's the question. Why do they have to do that, right? If there's a lot of support in different places. And I think that that should be a conversation, a welcoming conversation for different sources to come together and sponsor other leagues, other individual sports, other funds, whatever it is.
That was the two-time singles Grand Slam winner, Victoria Azarenka. Well, let's head to Paris now, where crowds have been flocking to the city's Pompidou Centre, because from tomorrow, this iconic art and cultural hub will be closed for renovations and remedial work, work that's due to last 5 years. I've been talking to journalist Morgan Eyre, formerly a producer here on NewsHour, who's been down there today to gauge the mood among visitors sneaking in before the shutters come down.
I am standing outside the Pompidou Centre currently. There is still a steady stream of people going in. There's a lot of bars around. There's been entertainment. That is a usual part of the Paris experience outside the Pompidou Centre. But I was speaking to some people a little earlier who told me that they are a little worried that when the Pompidou Centre does close, this area might become a little dead and it might kind of lose its heart.
It's a place where I would go often, so it would be a little strange.
There was like an exhibition about the surrealistic movement recently, and it was marvelous. I have no words. Yes, there is a sort of, you know, last day mood, but it's not sad. I would say it's joyful.
It brings a lot of people here, so if it closes, it will be just kind of empty here, because there's always this big like line of people waiting to come inside.
Morgan, For those who haven't visited the Pompidou Centre, just tell us what it looks like, first of all, because it's a pretty idiosyncratic building, isn't it?
It is in the 4th arrondissement of Paris, so it's surrounded by what you would typically associate with that kind of Paris Haussmannian style architecture, you know, the very ornate iron wrought balconies. The Pompidou Centre, by contrast, looks like what I can describe as a giant factory. It's got lots of kind of ventilation pipes going up, lots of metal structures, all different colours. There's a big, it's called the Caterpillar. It's basically a long outdoor escalator that leads right to the top of the Pompidou Centre. And from there, you can see the entire city of Paris pretty much.
Paris is blessed with lots of museums. How does the Pompidou Centre fit into that? What's it used for? What does it display?
It is the biggest collection of modern and contemporary art in Europe. Last year, I believed it had about 3.2 million visitors. There's pieces by, you know, Kandinsky. They've had exhibitions on surrealism. They have a Frida Kahlo piece. Some of the sculptures kind of include what different sort of TVs, for example, stacked on top of each other. And there might be a lot of paintings in there that some people may look at and say, I could do that, but you didn't. So I guess that's the point of the piece.
But it is now going to have to close. 5 years, I mean, seems like a long time. What's the reason behind that? What are they having to do?
So they are doing some renovation work, and they're also going to be removing some asbestos as well. This building was, in fact, it opened in 1977. So it does need to kind of upgrade some of those sort of safety and environmental concerns that we would want to put in place in 2025. They have an architect firm coming in to revamp, I believe, the interiors. The outside is very, very iconic, and they'll just be improving access, disability access.
I mean, you know, sad for people who've used the museum a lot, and I know you're a fan. Just tell us a bit about why you took the Pompidou Centre to heart, why it became important to you. It's rather a nice story.
I love the Pompidou Centre. It's my favourite in Paris. And apart from, I do like the art, I do like that kind of, what does that mean side of things. But actually what the library attached to the Pompidou Centre does, for people that are, that French is not their first language, I was brand new last year, and they organise conversation workshops. And you go in groups and they take you into the exhibitions and pair you up with people and you discuss the art. I was in a group with an older gentleman from Ukraine, a couple of Italian women, all who were there to improve and learn French. And actually one of those women, she went on to become a very, very good friend of mine. There is more going on at the Pompidou Centre than just art.
That was the freelance journalist Morgan Eyre talking to me about the closure of Paris's Pompidou Centre from tomorrow. It's going to be closed for the next 5 years. You're listening to News Hour from the BBC World Service. We're not close. Do stay with us. Much more coming up in the next half hour. Welcome back to News Hour. One of South Africa's best-known playwrights, Athol Fugard, has died at the age of 92. A long-time critic of apartheid, Fugard was known for plays such as Master Harold and the Boys and Sizwe Banzi is Dead, which he devised alongside the actors John Carney and Winston Nchona, who in 1976 were detained by the South African government. In an interview in 2010, Fugard spoke to the BBC about his efforts to get them freed.
There was an incident, in fact, when the two actors in Sizwe Banzi is Dead were actually detained in one of the so-called phony homelands that the apartheid government set up for the black people, were detained and imprisoned. And when I sent the word out to the international theatre community, they wasted no time. The protests flowed in and forced the government to release those two men.
As well as a writer, Athol Fugard was also an actor. And in 2006, an adaptation of his novel Tsotsi won the Best Foreign Language Oscar. Vincent Dowd looks back at his career.
Internationally, Athol Fugard was the South African playwright who put apartheid on stage. Sometimes, though, he did it in unexpected ways.
Ballroom must look happy, not like hard work. Romance.
What romance?
Love story with a happy ending. A handsome man in tails, in his arms, a beautiful lady in evening dress.
Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers.
You've got it.
Master Harold and the Boys, Fugard's best-known play, is set in 1950 in the Eastern Cape province where Fugard had grown up. Athol Fugard dramatised how badly, as a boy, he'd treated black servants. Yet the play also contains comedy and ballroom dancing. His mother had been an Afrikaner, his father was of English descent. In his 30s, Fugard became his country's best-known playwright. He set up theatre groups in Cape Town and Johannesburg. His plays, usually premiered abroad, included Statements After an Arrest Under the Immorality Act and Sizwe Banzi Is Dead, developed jointly with actors John Carney and Winston and Shona. He lived partly in California, but mainly in South Africa's Eastern Cape, an area he loved all his life.
I've often thought about what fascinates me about the Eastern Cape, and the nearest I've come to understanding something of my fascination with it is that I have a very, very strong sense of myself as a regional writer. I feel happiest when I am rooted in the specifics of the one place and the one time that I know.
Fugard won many awards. In the apartheid era, the South African government saw him as a nuisance, but most of the time tolerated him. From the 1990s, he wrote less about politics, but in his middle years, his best plays won Athol Fugard a reputation around the world.
Vincent Dowd, looking back at the life and career of Athol Fugard, who's died at the age of 92. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. This is the BBC in London. You're listening to NewsHour, and I'm James Menendez. Let's head to Canada now, because in a couple of hours, as the country's governing Liberal Party will announce who'll replace Justin Trudeau as its leader and therefore Prime Minister. There are four candidates in the running. Let's hear who they are from the BBC's Rebecca Hartman.
Mark Carney launches.
Former governor of the Bank of Canada.
Mark Carney is now officially entering the race.
Of the four candidates vying to become the next Prime Minister of Canada, Mark Carney is the frontrunner.
But one core principle has guided my life's work ever since. Markets don't have values. People do.
The man who was governor of the Bank of Canada in the wake of the 2008 financial crash, and then the Bank of England as the UK left the European Union, has the endorsement of many members of Trudeau's cabinet.
Whether it's affordability, housing, fighting climate change, or...
The other candidates are the Liberal House leader, Carina Gould, who has served in numerous positions in Mr. Trudeau's government.
And what I believe in to get our economy going is what I call investing in ourselves.
And Frank Bayliss, a former Liberal Member of Parliament, whose campaign has focused on his experience in business.
Donald Trump's nickname for me is the killer.
And the former Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland. Her resignation as Finance Minister and Deputy Prime Minister in December was a huge political blow to Mr. Trudeau and added to the growing pressure for him to resign.
Well, whoever wins from those four candidates, they'll have to deal with an increasingly strained relationship with the US and also discontent over the high cost of living. I've been talking to Martina Stevens-Gridnev, Canada Bureau Chief for the New York Times. First, does she think that Mark Carney is likely to be crowned the winner?
I think every poll shows that. It's clear that he has an edge. That being said, I do want to flag to listeners that the party is using a ranked ballot, which means that if Mr. Carney doesn't win the first round outright, you know, ranked ballot systems sometimes produce surprises. So there's still an outside chance. And I think it's important to note that Chrystia Freeland is the runner-up.
He is not a member of parliament, though. Does that mean that if he were to win, there would have to be an election rather sooner than later?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that his campaign has already indicated that. And so I believe that that's what we should expect. If he does win this vote tonight, he'll likely be sworn in prime minister early next week, perhaps Monday or Tuesday. And then our expectation is that, yes, he would call a federal election as soon as possible, which, by the way, seems to also be what most Canadians want.
Right. But so it's not an obstacle to becoming prime minister if you haven't got a seat in parliament.
Not technically.
Yeah. The Liberal Party under Justin Trudeau had been flailing pretty badly in the polls a few months ago. What impact has Donald Trump had on the party's popularity?
The Liberals have had a tremendous Trump bump. It It's really actually stunning to see the turnaround. As you said, they were trailing the Conservatives so badly. At some point, it was 27 percentage points. Imagine that. And the removal of Justin Trudeau from the equation and Mr. Trump's persistent menacing threats to Canadian sovereignty through tariffs, but also other threats that he's leveled, including on their border, those seem to have galvanized people around the Liberals. So while we're in a situation of flux, of course, and a new leader would give, would give Canadian voters some time to think whether, you know, they truly want the Liberals back in office. They have been craving change. It's so far been working very well for the Liberals and very badly for the Conservatives, who are just seen as too similar, perhaps, to Mr. Trump, whether that's fair or not.
Yeah. And on Donald Trump's rhetoric about Canada becoming America's 51st state, I mean, how's that been regarded now, a few weeks in? I mean, is it still regarded as bluster, a negotiating tactic, or are people, especially in government, taking it very seriously indeed?
Well, I think Canadians, did not think it was a joke from the start. And I think the rest of the world is catching up. My reporting shows, we had a story about this on Thursday, an exclusive, shows that the Canadian government takes it deadly seriously because Donald Trump specifically told Justin Trudeau on a phone call in early February that he wanted to revise the border treaty between the two countries, as well as water sharing agreements. And then top officials from the Trump administration told top Canadian officials going further that the president was interested in, for example, removing Canada from the Five Eyes intelligence sharing agreement that Britain is part of, revisiting their military cooperation, which is really key to especially the aerospace in North America. So this is really, really serious stuff. And I think Canadians are just feeling a very, very small relief to see that the world is catching up to what they've known from the start, that this is menacing. It's not a joke.
That was the New York Times' Martina Stevens-Gridner speaking to me from Ottawa, and the result of that leadership contest in about 45 minutes' time, in fact. Now, the World Health Organization has estimated that one in every 100 people in Gaza has a life-changing injury because of the conflict with Israel. It's difficult for many to leave the territory to get medical treatment. However, a team of Jordanian medics has been able to enter Gaza and fit those who've lost limbs with cutting-edge prosthetics which clip on quickly and easily. Our Middle East correspondent Yolan Nell has been hearing from innovators, medics and those who have been helped.
In a few months, Lieutenant Abdullah Hameda and his team have seen some 300 patients, fitting each of them with a life-changing prosthetic limb. He's working out of a van at the field hospital that's been specially kitted out. And this fast manufacturing really is something groundbreaking, a world first. Lieutenant Hameda tells me the new technology is having a huge impact on every person he fits.
You can't do anything. We are giving him his life back.
Restoring Hope is being funded by a national Jordanian charity and is the brainchild of the Jordanian King Abdullah II. And when the war in Gaza was still raging, Ahmed Kaloub, a father in his 20s, came into a tent in Restoring Hope's mobile clinic in Gaza for a checkup with clinician Lieutenant Hameda. He tells me that the prosthetic which he had fitted a few weeks ago has changed his life.
I was struggling to go up and down. Thank God, once I got the prosthetic, I started slowly returning to my normal life. I can now dress myself, go wherever I want. Nothing can stop me now.
The key to it all is a cone made of a special plastic which can be remoulded at high temperatures.
This looks a bit like an industrial hairdryer.
And that's exactly what this is. This is a heat gun which allows us to heat up plastics and manipulate plastics in conventional prosthetics. But we've taken it and created a way of allowing it to heat up our cone.
American prosthetist Alex De Hinton leaves the plastic cone in a makeshift cylindrical oven and goes back to his patient. He is a local man called Hossam. Within about 15 minutes, Alex has fitted pads on Hossam's leg stump, and now the cone is ready.
So now our plastic is the perfect temperature to be able to mold it directly on his limb. It cuts beautifully. When this material is warm, it cuts almost like butter.
He says this technique is much more efficient than what he would have done in the past. There's no plaster casting, no hazardous chemicals.
I almost feel like I dreamed of this material and thought of this material before I was aware of it. It really opens up the opportunities.
And you're getting lifetime feedback.
Yeah, so we can ask if it's feeling, how's it feeling? Is it comfortable? Is it too hot? The thumbs up is a universal symbol.
Alex works for Amparo, the company that developed the new prosthetics, and he's helped train the Jordanian medics now using them in Gaza. The whole setup is very mobile, and there's another useful, special feature of this plastic. It can be remolded up to 5 times.
So as someone starts to shrink down, starts to get more active again, their leg starts to change. If it changes to a degree where they need a whole new socket, they can come in, and within about half an hour, this socket can be heated and remolded onto their leg.
Fast forward another 45 minutes with Hossam, and...
So this is the moment of truth?
Yeah, it is. Pull it off. There we go.
Can I feel the material? It's hard now. It's amazing. Once it's finished.
We've effectively recreated the shape of his limb in a hard socket.
And with some on-the-spot adjustments and a foot part attached to a plate built into the socket, before you know it, Hossam is putting on his left trainer and he's walking, taking great strides.
It's
good.
Yola now reporting there for the BBC programme People Fixing the World. You can hear the full edition wherever you get your BBC podcasts. Russia's recruiting criminal gangs in the UK for widespread acts of espionage, according to an investigative journalist targeted by Bulgarian nationals working for Moscow. 3 of the Bulgarians were convicted in a London court on Friday of spying in one of the largest foreign intelligence operations on UK soil. One man in the gang's crosshairs was the investigative journalist Christo Grozev. He exposed the Russians behind the Salisbury poisonings in 2018. He now works at the Insider and Der Spiegel. He told my colleague Paddy O'Connell he's lucky to be alive and began by explaining how the Kremlin is increasingly using outsourced spying.
This is a trend that we have seen develop after some failures of Russian intelligence. But one of the failures was actually the disclosure of the Russian spies that attempted to assassinate Sergei Skripal and almost killed his daughter and did kill a British citizen, Don Sturges, in 2018. Several other operations were blundered and then spies were disclosed, partly thanks to reporting of open source investigators like Bellingcat. And this led to the necessity for Russia to use less discernible operatives. And they moved in the direction of freelancers and non-professional spies and outsourced violence as one of the ways that they could disguise and obfuscate their involvement in certain operations.
But actually, there's serious intent to kill, kidnap, and undermine.
There is some of the problems with outsourced violence that these non-spies, they do not know how to de-escalate. Professional spies would know not to continue with an operation when innocent people, bystanders, family members, lives are at risk. The spies that were working for the Russian intelligence services entered my apartment in Vienna in 2022. And I just don't want to think about what would have happened if my son had decided to go out of his room during their burglary.
Can we list some of the ways they plotted to kill you?
Hiring an ISIS suicide bomber and having him explode himself next to me in the street, bludgeoning me to death using a sledgehammer. Kidnapped me and sent me to a torture camp in Syria, while another man with a latex mask with my face would fly ostensibly to Russia on a commercial flight in order to be arrested in front of cameras for full deniability. The fantasy and imagination of these wannabe spies is beyond any imagination.
Did you ever actively suddenly realize you were being filmed long before you proved it?
I did have a couple of incidents across Europe. I remember that my then 14-year-old daughter told me, "Dad, I think there's a spy following us." And in fact, it turns out a member of the group who's now been convicted was watching us to make sure we don't go back into the apartment.
And that was the investigative journalist Christo Grozev there. You're listening to NewsHour. This is James Menendez with NewsHour. We used to have wake-up calls, but in recent days, we received an electroshock. The words of a former German ambassador to Washington last week, talking about the impact of the Trump administration on America's relationship with Europe, and in particular the dramatic shift in Washington's approach to the war in Ukraine. In an effort to end the conflict and get Europe to do more of the heavy lifting, President Trump has suspended military aid and intelligence sharing with Ukraine. He's also called President Zelensky a dictator, and, of course, there was that very public dressing down at the White House. Well, today, in an interview with Fox News, Donald Trump repeated his criticism of Mr. Zelensky.
He took money out of this country under Biden like candy from a baby. It was so easy. And I just don't think he's grateful. We gave him, in my opinion, $350 billion. Europe is in for $100 billion. We gave him $350 billion, and he's talking about the fact that they have fought and they have, there's a bravery.
Well, there's little evidence of similar pressure being put on Russia to make compromises. In fact, Washington's already suggested that President Putin will get to keep much of the territory it's taken, and the NATO membership for Ukraine is a non-starter. And so, in the minds of many in Europe and Canada too, it looks as if the transatlantic alliance is on life support. Well, I've been discussing this with George Beebe, Director of Grand Strategy at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft in Washington, also a former Director of Russia Analysis at the CIA, and Evelyn Farkas, Executive Director of the McCain Institute, named after the US Senator John McCain and a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Russia and Ukraine. That was under President Obama. First to George Beebe. Does he think the US is siding with Russia?
Well, no, I don't think the Trump administration is siding with Russia. I think what Trump is trying to do is to end this war in a compromise settlement. And I think he recognizes that this war is not going to end in Russian capitulation or unconditional surrender. There's going to have to be a compromise. And what the Russians are looking for is a geopolitical compromise. They want the United States to recognize that NATO's enlargement into Ukraine or some sort of American military presence in Ukraine is a security threat to Russia. And I think they're going to have to concede that Ukraine will be a sovereign, independent country, that it will be reconstructed, and that it has a viable path toward membership in the European Union. So that's the process that I think we have underway. And the Ukrainians have to understand that that's the direction that they need to go to. And right now, Zelensky is not saying he's willing to do that.
Okay. Evelyn Farkas, is that how you see the dynamic at the moment?
No, not at all. I would disagree that the Ukrainian government doesn't want peace. The Ukrainian government does want peace. The Ukrainian government does want an end to the war. And I don't think that Vladimir Putin's objection is to NATO enlargement, because, of course, Sweden and Finland just joined NATO and he barely mentions it. The issue is that this Russian president and his people around him in the Kremlin, they have a neo-imperial agenda. They want to absorb Ukraine into the Russian Federation, eliminate the Ukraine's sovereignty. So I don't think that, unfortunately, I don't think that the Russian government has an objective that allows Ukraine to maintain its sovereignty. And in fact, what's happening right now is it looks like we are driving or trying to drive Ukraine to an unconditional surrender, because our president has taken away leverage that Ukraine might have had in order to achieve the compromise that George describes. The other part of it is, of course, that the reason the Ukrainian government will not accept a compromise that ends where George described it without a security guarantee is because there's a lack of trust in the Kremlin and in President Putin, because he has signed agreements before for ceasefires, for the cessation of hostilities, and then he reinvaded. So the Ukrainians don't trust the Russians.
Yeah, let me put
and
that,
we shouldn't either.
let me put that precise point to George Beebe. Is the Trump administration being naive towards Vladimir Putin, that in fact he only understands hard power and may not keep his word?
Well, no, I don't think they're being naive at all. I think they recognize that the Russians are not simply going to end this war out of the goodness of their heart, out of goodwill, or because it's quote unquote the right thing to do. There's going to have to be a combination of diplomacy and force. In other words, there will need to be a deterrent force, and that's going to take two forms, I think. One is going to be Ukraine's own self-defense capabilities, and the other is going to be NATO and the strength of NATO's own military capabilities vis-a-vis Russia, which have to be built up. I think that's clearly an element of this that the Trump administration is focusing on. But the other part of this is we have done deals, quote unquote, arms control deals, confidence and security building measures, other kinds of diplomatic understandings throughout the Cold War period with the Soviet Union. We didn't trust the Soviet Union to adhere to those deals because the Soviet Union was trustworthy or good in any way. We trusted but verified, as Ronald Reagan put it. We put in place the means to verify compliance. That worked pretty well during the Cold War period. I don't think anyone would go back and say, you know, we actually should have fought to liberate the Baltic states from Soviet domination. So we understood how to do this then. I think we understand now how to do it.
I just want to ask you both one final question in the sort of minute and a half we've got left. And Evelyn Farkas, first of all, how much damage has been done to the transatlantic relationship over all this?
It's on the brink of rupture. It's really in terrible distress. And I would say I was in the Pentagon when Vladimir Putin dismantled all of those conventional and nuclear arms agreements. So unfortunately, again, it's Vladimir Putin that's the problem here. If there were another Russian government, maybe there'd be a shot. But the damage that is being done right now, it's not completely broken, but there's, again, we're on the brink of something very new here.
George Beebe, does that matter if America's allies can't trust it anymore? Does it simply matter that America's national interest is looked after?
Well, I think the Trump administration actually wants a strong and healthy Europe and a strong and healthy transatlantic alliance. What it doesn't want is a situation where Europe continues to outsource its security to the United States, where Europe is essentially a subordinate vassal to the United States without its own capabilities of deterring Russia. We're heading into a multipolar order. And I think the Trump administration recognizes that in that order, Europe has to be one of the poles.
And that was George Beebe of the Quincy Institute in Washington. I was also talking to Evelyn Farkas, Executive Director of the McCain Institute, also in Washington, D.C. And that brings us to the end of this edition of NewsHour. From me and the rest of the team here in London, thanks so much for being with us. Until the next time, bye-bye.